Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Starseed Radio Academy, empowering Starseed to better serve the planet.
Welcome to Starseed Radio Academy. It's Tuesday, April 29th, 2014, and I'm your host, Ariel Taylor, with my co-hosts, Lavendar and Anastasia. Our special guest this evening is Marie Jones, who's a best-selling author, screenwriter, researcher, and public speaker. She's appeared on the History Channel's Nostradamus Effect and Ancient Aliens television series, and is the co-host of Dreamland Radio. She's written and lectured widely about cutting-edge science, the paranormal, ufology, consciousness, noetics, and metaphysics. Her latest release is entitled This Book is from the Future, A Journey Through Portals, Relativity, Wormholes, and Other Adventures in Time Travel. Don't you love it? And you can find a long list of fascinating titles of her other books at her website, which is mariedjones.com. And that's M-A-R-I-E, Marie, D like David, and Jones, J-O-N-E-S, mariedjones.com. Well, we have one more show before the May Crystal Quest to Arkansas, and we'll be gone for two Tuesdays, so take a look in our archives for any shows you may have missed. You might want to take that chance to get caught up. There's a lot from Lavendar's Vault available on demand all the time. Tonight, we are announcing our next Crystal Quest, which is in September, 21 through 27, and we already have reservations for that trip. If you have 25, 26, 27 degrees in any of these signs, Taurus, Scorpio, Cancer, Capricorn, Aquarius, or Leo, you have the rites of passage to participate. So just send an email to crystals@starseedhotline.com for more details. At the top of the show, it's the Starseed News segment with Anastasia, bringing topics of interest to Starseed and sharing some emails from our listeners. We'd like to thank Fiona and Vanya for hosting the switchboard this evening, and you can call in with questions or comments for Marie on 917-889-8292, and make sure you press 1 so we know you want to come on the air. We also have an online Starseed community at starseedhotline.ning.com, and special thanks to Tammy for her dedication to the forum. Starseed Hotline's toll-free number is 888-881-0881. The Stage 1 Starseed confirmations are based on Lavendar's discovery of star markings and your natal astrological chart, and the Stage 2 session is a one-on-one phone session available with Lavendar, Anastasia, or myself. Remote healing sessions for people and pets are also available with Tammy. And if you have a birthday coming up, you can find out how to make the most of your 10 hours of power by requesting your solar return timing. So I would like to introduce Anastasia first this evening. Good evening, Anastasia. You got to turn your mute off.
There we go. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Ariel, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Are you? Anastasia, we can hear you.
Okay, I've lost my sound.
Okay, let's see.
Hold on. Can you hear me?
Yes. Can you hear me? I can hear you.
Okay. You know what?
All right.
I can't hear you. I can hear you barely.
Okay. Can you hear me a little bit?
We are having a temporary technical difficulty.
Okay.
Hang on, let me see if I can fix the wires here. Is Mercury retrograde?
No.
Don't think so, but it is in this office. Hold on, everybody.
Ariel, do you think
you could sing to him for a couple of minutes? Hold on. We're going to do something different.
Okay.
All right. I am on. I am here.
Okay. Can you hear me
now?
All right?
I'm sorry, that took 5 minutes. Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
We had a crisis for a moment there. Our wiring went out, but I'm resourceful. I found another method to get online, so here we are.
There you go, thinking on your feet.
Well, it's good to be with everybody tonight, and I'm sorry for that little interruption. But we've got all kinds of news, and I'm sure many of you have heard some of these stories, and some of them are going to be new to you, but we have a couple of near-Earth asteroids flying by Earth this very day. Asteroid 2014 HE5 is only going to be 9.7 lunar distances away. It's 36 meters in diameter. And 2014 HV2, coming by also today, is 1.4 lunar distance away, and its size is 28 meters. They're finding new ones all the time, and these are just two happening to fly by today. So wave hi, everybody, and send them on their way.
Yeah.
Well, in New Hampshire, there have been more loud booms in the last week. This just happened after last week's show. Something rattled houses in the Keene area in New Hampshire on Wednesday, and despite official reports to the contrary, people are convinced it just had to be a sonic boom. Now, there was no evidence that there was a sonic boom, but residents reported a loud noise about 2:15 p.m. in the afternoon. People said it shook their homes and rattled their windows, so nobody knows what it was. And there was a fireball meteor over Japan twice this past week, April 19th and actually April 17th. That was recorded on videotape or cameras. It was very bright. Big fireball over Japan occurred. And in Bangladesh, India, at least 16 people were found dead and 1,000 have been made homeless by a severe storm in northern Bangladesh. The storm tore through scores of villages overnight on this last Sunday, uprooting trees and electrical poles and derailing a train in one incident that injured dozens and dozens of passengers. And there's been a mysterious man-eating hole, actually plural, many holes, that have appeared suddenly in sand dunes in the Mount Baldy, Indiana Park. It's the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore Park. A six-year-old boy, last summer they say, was walking across the sands of Mount Baldy, and he suddenly dropped into a deep hole. Since then, they've closed the park because these holes keep reappearing, and no one knows where they're coming from. By the way, it took rescuers about 3 hours to pull this little boy out of 11 feet of sand. And so they don't know what's going on. They say, we don't know exactly what's happening. We can't let folks onto the area until we know it's safe. So the park is still closed. And so if you're planning on going up there, you might want to know that the park is not open due to these mysterious holes. And my, do we have the weather. Right now outside my office, I'm getting hail. And we have had quite the episode. You know, it started actually on Friday in North Carolina. There was tornadoes that hit North Carolina on Friday. Actually, it was Saturday, excuse me, and touched down. And 15 people were transported to the hospital from that. There were also, they say, an undetermined number of walking wounded from that event. And then, of course, the next day or on Monday, we had all kinds of tornadoes in North Carolina. We just said North Carolina, excuse me. This was yesterday. They say that buildings were destroyed while vehicles and caravans were thrown into the air, and they said that at least 17 people as of yesterday were killed by tornadoes in that huge storm that swept across the central and southern United States. Now, many of these were in Little Rock, Arkansas, near where we have our crystal quest. And there was another incident or another casualty from Oklahoma. Yesterday, tornadoes also struck in Nebraska, Kansas, Iowa, and Missouri. And today, they say that we're facing a massive storm system with 70 million Americans under threat of severe weather. From Missouri, they say, to all the way to New York, Michigan, to Florida, forecasters have urged millions of us to keep an eye on the weather today, warning of tornadoes, high winds, and hail spawned by the storm system that killed a total of 31 people, they say now, in the last 2 days. So they say that we really need to keep our eyes open from Mississippi to Alabama
Oklahoma, Arkansas, all of those other areas, as well as where I live, this whole region of the country, Florida, Georgia, Carolinas, even the Mid-Atlantic states, they say there is a slight risk for severe weather today. So we'll see what happens. Looking outside my window today, the weather has been really very unpredictable and real dicey. And like I said, we're getting hail at this very moment. I wasn't even sure I was going to be able to come on the air tonight. So we'll just see what happens with that. You know, I just had read a few days ago, just before these tornadoes hit, that this has been the lowest recorded season, a season of recorded tornadoes in many years, that this had been a record low for tornadoes because the weather has been so cool. And shortly, within a day or so after I read that article, and I was going to actually put it in tonight's news, then these storm systems hit. So looks like nature's making up for lost time. Well, there's something really interesting that they've discovered, that they have found that there are atmospheric teleconnections that link the North and South Poles. They say that long-distance atmospheric connections between the North and South Poles are linking weather and climate in far-distance parts of the globe. And this is according to data from NASA's AIM spacecraft. I've told you about the AIM spacecraft before. They say that these so-called teleconnections explain why, like during the polar vortex that we had this year, that the winter air temperature in Indianapolis correlated with a reduction in high-altitude clouds over Antarctica thousands of miles away. They say that changes in the polar regions in the north are communicated all the way over to the other side of the globe. And they say that we are now finding out how completely connected the Earth is from one end to the other. There's a feedback system. They say that if you change temperature in one area but not in another, it still changes the winds. So whatever happens in the northern hemisphere propagates down to the southern hemisphere. This is something that's entirely new to science. They're very intrigued by this. But the Native Americans and the Aboriginals could have easily explained this to us because they have taught all along that all things are connected. So more and more science is finding that the Earth is an organism that has many means of connecting and communicating, and that really one side of the globe really does affect the other side of the globe. You know the butterfly effect? We've talked mm-hmm. about that.
Yeah.
And also up in the upper atmosphere, they say they have found, as early as last winter, scientists from the Georgia Institute of Technology discovered that billions of bacteria actually thrive in the Earth's upper atmosphere. Now, this is a place that's below freezing. It almost has no oxygen. It's flooded with ultraviolet radiation. And forever we have thought that it's no place for anything to live up there. Nothing could live up there. I remember being taught that in school. But researchers have since flown 6 miles above the Earth's surface in the NASA plane. And while they were up there, they pumped outside air through a filter to collect particles so they could bring it back down to Earth and put it in a lab. And once they got down here, they counted up all the organisms that they pulled in from up in the upper atmosphere, and the count was staggering. 20% of what they had assumed to be just dust or other particles was alive. It was teeming with life. They have wow. found that Earth is surrounded by a live bubble of bacteria, including E. coli and Streptococcus. Isn't that fascinating?
Wow.
Now, scientists don't yet know what the bacteria are doing up there. They say they may be essential to how the atmosphere functions. For example, maybe they're responsible for recycling nutrients in the atmosphere like they do on Earth. And similar to other particles, they could even influence weather patterns by helping the clouds form. We don't know. But they say they could also be transmitting diseases from one side of the globe to the other. Now, while the researchers found E. coli in their samples, which they think hurricanes picked up from cities, they plan to investigate whether it could be possible for plagues and other diseases to rain down on the population from the upper atmosphere. So this is a whole new study in infectious disease control. But it's all very fascinating, and it's relatively new news. So, and you know, what's going on with astronomy is so fascinating. They are preparing to map the Milky Way galaxy, and it's a big job. The Milky Way, our home galaxy in a vast universe, contains 400 billion suns, at least that many planets, and a 4 billion solar mass black hole at its center. Well, they think, anyway. They don't really know. Because the fact is, a comprehensive understanding of our Milky Way structure has eluded researchers because it's just impossible to get to the big picture of something when you're locked inside of it. So scientists say that they are fairly confident that the Milky Way is a spiral galaxy, but we don't know much about it. And at the most basic level, scientists want to make a map that would show in detail what our galaxy looks like. What a project. They have big ambitions. And so what they've done, they've started using the Very Long Base Array. I've told you about that before. It's called the VLBA. And it's a system of 10 radio telescopes spanning the globe from Hawaii to New England to the Virgin Islands. And using this system, scientists are studying so-called masers, naturally occurring sources of laser-like radio waves from clouds of gas that are near luminous stars. That's a maser. They're using those to map our galaxy, they say, in unprecedented detail. Now, previous studies of the Milky Way structure were limited to nearby stars or relied on inferring distances from measurements of things like the speed of gas clouds approaching or receding away from us. Well, they've decided that these techniques are not reliable enough to discern the finer points of our Milky Way structure, so they've tried to get precise values. They want to get the distance to the galactic center and the speed with which our sun rotates around our galactic center, and so to do so, they measured something called parallax. Well, that's an effect that reflects the apparent position of an object when viewed from two different vantage points. Now, I know this gets complicated, people, but hang in there with me. They say that this is the same technique that they use for surveying on Earth, only they have carried it forward with extraordinary accuracy using this VLBA. Now, since this VLBA is in the northern hemisphere, it can only see about half of the Milky Way. So the next step is to take the same measurements in the southern hemisphere. And they think that once they do that, it should be possible to trace the Milky Way's arms from their origin to the core, from the core of the galaxy, around to the outer parts. And ground-based observations will soon be extended, they say, by the European Space Agency's Gaia spacecraft, which launched this last December. We've talked about Gaia. They say that Gaia aims to measure the distances to 1 billion stars by about 2020. Wow, we are going where no one has gone before. If they can get that right, that should be so fascinating. But, you know, I just assumed we knew what we looked like. But we don't, because we're inside of ourselves as being within the galaxy. So it only stands to reason that there is a whole lot to be mapped and a whole lot to be discovered. Well, in California, they are now saying, out of the LA Times, that drought covers 100% of the state in one way or another. The latest drought monitor released by the National Climatic Data shows that the entire state is under moderate drought conditions, but within that map, 76.6% of the state is experiencing extreme drought conditions, and for 24% of the state, the level of dryness is exceptional. Now, they say that during the same period last year, none of the state was considered to be under extreme or exceptional drought conditions. None of the state. And just 30% fell under the severe category. Many municipalities right now, though, across the entire state are instituting voluntary conservation measures, but customers of water customers in Santa Cruz, it's not so voluntary. They have cut their water use by 25% or they get financial penalties. Now, NOAA reported last week that half of the Sierra Nevada snowpack liquid melted in 1 week because there wasn't much. There wasn't much. And they say that it did very little to boost reservoirs. So even though they've had a little bit of rain and they've had some melting, no change. So California is really in dire straits. They need water. And there was a wonderful article out of the Telegraph about color and about the color receptors in our eyes. And I want to share this with you. They say that the scientific evidence for the effect of color on our emotions and behavior is growing. Scientists are studying this. They say that red makes us more attractive, blue more alert. Pink, on the other hand, makes a man a weakling. Can you believe that? They've actually done studies. They painted some prison cells pink, and the prisoners got weak, they say. The male prisoners lost a lot of their physical strength. And anyway, because of a lot of these odd studies, sort of oddball studies, they say that finally the science of color is really being looked at, because there are indicators that there's a lot more to it than, pardon the pun, meets the eye. They say that it points to one thing. Our perception of color really does affect our minds and our physical well-being. A 2004 study found that football teams wearing red were statistically more likely to win than teams in other colors. And a study in 2008 found that male volunteers that were shown photos of attractive women who were presented in front of red and white backgrounds, well, when the men looked at these photographs, they rated the women on the red background as more good-looking. So they say that people really, you know, are affected by color in their likes, their dislikes, and how it affects their moods and emotions. However, here's the kicker. You know, we come to understand that everything is an illusion, and it really is. We only see 1% of the visible color spectrum or the visible light spectrum. And the scientists are now saying to us, they're reminding us, that color doesn't really exist in this world. They say that blue isn't a property of denim or of skies or oceans, but of how our eyes interpret a particular set of wavelengths of electromagnetic radiation, which we call visible light. Red isn't a property of blood, but it is a property of how our eyes interpret another longer set of wavelengths, because red is a longer wavelength than blue. Scientists are telling us now that human vision is trichromatic. It's like color television. We have three different color receptors or cones in our eyes, and each is designed to pick up different wavelengths of light. They are red, green, and blue, as they've been identified. Now, they say that most mammals, apart from a few apes, have two receptors, and most colorblind people also are limited to two receptors, meaning that they can only detect green and blue wavelengths. If we had only one receptor, we'd see the world in black and white. But get this, while we human beings have three color receptors, mantis shrimps have 12, and birds have 4. And scientists are reporting that when birds see red, they don't just see plain red. They see a whole palette, an array of scintillating variations because of their extra receptor. Wow. Now, they say that how we see the wavelengths of light around us affect our circadian rhythms or our biological clock. And they say that this is affected not only by the brightness of the light we're exposed to, but the color of the light. This is really interesting, guys. They say that the optic nerve is especially sensitive to blue light, specifically the blue of a blue sky. Now, if you're exposed to the light of this color, it will make you more alert. They say that blue light keeps us awake far more effectively than red light. And, you know, if you want to go to sleep, you don't want to be in a blue room or be looking at a blue light, because it'll keep you awake. If you want to sleep, they say the color red is far more beneficial, or orange, or so on and so forth, which explains why that lovely salt lamp that I have, if I have that on before nighttime, I really sleep much better. And they also say that before going to bed at night, you should dim your lights in the house. Don't stay under bright floodlights when you're preparing for bed. Give your body a chance to adjust to less and less light. They have found that in our artificial environments, it's really disrupting our biological clocks, because we have our lights on all the time. We don't live by sunrise, sunset anymore. And they're saying that's really important for our health. So I love those Tibetan salt lamps. They're just wonderful and very soothing. Not only do they put out that wonderful negative ions, but they really do soothe the eyes. And any of you that are having difficulty sleeping, try that. It's a wonderful thing. Well, that's going to be it for tonight's news, and I thank you for your patience with my technical difficulty.
Oh, it was nothing. Don't worry about it.
I'm looking forward to tonight's show.
As are we, and I want to thank you, Anastasia. That was some amazing stuff. It really food for thought. I'll have to be rolling that one around for a while.
Well, you know, we're so certain of the things that we see, and we're so certain in our 3D selves of reality that we are, you know, people will tell you that are not into metaphysics, well, if you can't see it, it's not real. What they don't understand is there is so little that we can see. And as a clairvoyant, I can tell you that in the higher dimensions, there are colors that don't exist in our range of perception here. When you're using your third eye, you see colors that don't exist in this spectrum, and that's absolutely astonishing, beautiful, and phenomenal. So it's just a reminder for us to sort of be aware that sometimes our certainties are way misplaced. And if we could live like the natives and the Hopi and the aboriginals, we would learn to think with more with our hearts and less with our heads, because the heart feels things and opens up those centers of receptivity to spirituality and to the spiritual greater reality that is all around us all the time. Just because we can't see it doesn't mean it isn't there. So that's something to think about, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Anastasia, for the news this evening. And I am going to first bring Lavendar on. Hello, Lavendar.
I'm here. Is Anastasia, are you still there?
Yeah.
She's still there. We had two big booms that shook the house about 2 hours ago. I mean, huge. I mean, the foundation, the floor, the roof, the windows rattled. Have no idea what it was.
Wow.
It was huge. Just 2 hours ago.
Wow. Yeah, well, you know, they've been calling for storms here, but so far we haven't had any, so.
It's not storm. I'm not talking about storms. I'm talking about booms.
It wasn't like thunder. It was just those mysterious sky booms that you're talking about?
Sky booms. We didn't have any weather. It was sky booms.
Oh. Wow.
Sky booms, yeah. And it's really interesting that she talks about the eyes and the color and all of that, because for the last 2 or 3 days, I've been thinking a lot about that, about how there's other colors in other places, and if we close our eyes and we open them real quick, you know, the different frequencies that, you know, I've been tracking, not tracking exactly what she said, but that concept has really been on my brain for about 3 days, about how our perception about what we see through our eyes. Yeah, I'm so glad she brought that up.
Yeah, that's great. Well, we have Marie with us on the switchboard, so let me get your mic open first here. Hello, Marie. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Good to be here.
Well, it's great to have you back.
Yes, great. Thank
you. And you have a new book?
I think a few of them.
A few, yeah. I think since you were here before, you're quite the prolific writer.
Oh, boy.
Lavendar, I'm going to turn it over to you right now, because I know you have her book, so I'm looking forward to this.
Okay. I don't have your new book, but I have the book called The Grid.
Right. Okay. Yeah, there's only one after that, but.
Okay. Well, so, Mary, tell us a little bit about what prompted you to write this book, The Grid.
Well, it's actually sort of a culmination of a lot of the work that I had written about and that I had written about with my co-author, Larry Flaxman. We sort of wanted to bring it all together into one book where we, all of the research that we had done with the paranormal, with unknown anomalies, with the human aspect, you know, the part of that that is related to our consciousness and our awareness, the sort of the observer effect, we really wanted to bring it all together into this concept that when it comes to reality, really what we think is happening is that there are more than one levels of reality going on. So things that we call paranormal or supernatural may very well just be things that are occurring on another level of reality. And what might a visual of that look like? If we could see this infrastructure of realities, what might that look like? So it's really our way to kind of come up with a visual concept that people can wrap their minds around about the fact that there may be an infinite number of other realities out there.
Yes, I agree. I'm in your book, and in the introduction, I see there's several questions here, and that's where I'm going to now. Do parallel universes and alternate dimensions exist in the grid?
We believe they do, and a lot of the research that we've done over the years with different books that we've written into parallel universes and alternate dimensions of not just space, but actually time, two alternate timelines that may be operating, the concept of the multiverse that we hear so much about. A lot of these things sound very science fiction-ish, but the truth is that they're coming to us from the world of physics, from quantum and theoretical physics. So it's like, okay, if these guys are talking about this stuff, maybe there is something to it. Maybe there is something to the idea that this grid of realities that we exist in allows us at times to connect with and experience another timeline, another dimension, another universe. And those things may be what we call paranormal experiences. So seeing a ghost or having a psychic experience or being able to remote view or seeing some kind of entity, an alien or what have you, maybe what we're talking about here aren't necessarily things that we experience in our reality, but things that are kind of bleeding over from other parts of what we call the grid.
How does time operate in the grid, and is time travel possible?
We think it is because during the news, I was listening to the first half hour, and one of the stories talked about how, you know, the Earth is so interconnected, and what happens in one part of the globe can affect and influence the butterfly effect, obviously. And I think it operates in the same way in that in this grid of realities, which is the invisible part of our existence that we kind of know is there, but we can't prove because it happens on a hidden, implicate order. But in that order, there is no time. There is no past, present, and future because those are constructs of the human brain. We are the ones who have to give this arrow of time so that it makes sense, you know, so that the events of our lives can make sense to us. But outside of our perception, there is no past, present, and future. Everything happens at once. Everything is out there in the grid. So if we were somehow to find a way technologically to travel to these different realities, whether we're doing that mentally or physically, we should be able to go to different points in time because it is like a landscape that we can travel through. We just have to find the way of doing that.
What connects one level of the grid to another?
There are different things that we kind of call connectors. One of the big ones for us has been resonance, the idea that everything vibrates. Nothing is solid. Nothing is still. Everything is vibrating. And everything has its own resonant frequency. And if we can find ways of matching vibrational frequencies, that often opens the door for communication between those frequencies, sometimes for the creation of a new frequency. Another really big connector would be consciousness. You know, our bodies seem to be limited in what we can do, what we can experience. We can't jump into another alternate universe or another timeline at will, obviously. But our consciousness seems to be able to rise above that limitation when we're meditating, if we have a paranormal experience, maybe we have a psychic experience where we know something and, you know, it's verified for us, or we have a precognitive vision that comes true. I think dreams are an example of traveling through the grid. But our bodies are so limited, that, and you know, we're so focused on our bodies and on what the five senses see and what the five senses experience, that we sometimes forget that we're having all these other unusual experiences outside of the realm of the five senses. So consciousness, resonance, those are the big connectors that may allow us to align ourselves with another frequency or of another reality. I don't think that we can experience other realities 24/7 when we're just going about our day-to-day lives. I don't think we're meant to. I think we honestly are built to be able to survive in one reality at a time. Yeah, I think that's the limitation of the body and the brain. But our minds, our consciousness, that seems to be able to sort of rise above that and go out and do a little bit of traveling.
Is the grid organic, alive, conscious, or is it just a massive computer program?
Well, those people who believe both, that you know, either one of those theories has its supporters. I'll speak to the first one. I feel like, you know, just as we are evolving as individuals and as a species, the world, you know, our reality is evolving. The universe seems to be evolving. There seems to be a grander consciousness that we are a part of, we're embedded in, and yet it is evolving in a very similar way to the way we are as individuals. It's growing. It absorbs new information and then sort of snowballs and grows because of that. And it's always changing, always shifting. But what's funny about that is that even if we go back to the other idea that it's a big giant computer program, the same progress or the same process is at work. Because when you program a computer, basically what it spits out is what you programmed plus what it is able to process on top of that. And so the more you put into it, the more it's going to be able to process and spit. So either way, it seems that reality and the grid is ever evolving in much the same way that we are. And because I can't see it being a fixed, unevolving thing, because then at some point our own levels of consciousness would probably surpass it.
You know, several years ago, I received some information on the internet about a foundation that had a lot of computers they had turned on at once that was measuring consciousness on the planet.
Right, right.
Remember
yeah.
that?
Yeah, that was like the Global Consciousness Project, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
What did you think about that? I mean, does that go along with how you're tracking the grid and how that particular program was part of a grid consciousness?
Absolutely. In fact, Larry Flaxman, who co-wrote The Grid with me, he signed on for one of the, they're called EGGS, which was, you know, he was able to be a part of the Global Consciousness Program. He was one of the tracking stations, if you will, where, you know, they would put out a specific goal or intention or experiment, or they would look at things that were going on in the world, world events that were happening, whether they were natural disasters or tragedies or, you know, even really good things that people were participating in. And so he was getting the incoming data where he could look at it along with anyone else who had an egg around the country. And so he could, you know, I would go on and we would look and you could see where the data sort of rises. Like, say there was the Olympics, some big wonderful story that happened at the Olympics, and you could see the rise in the responses of the eggs, or maybe there was a tragic plane crash, or like 9/11, the terrorist attacks, there was an incredible increase in the non-random activity that these eggs were putting out, because normally what they're putting out is just random its and bits, ones and zeros, but when things begin to take on order, when chaos begins to take on some order, at the very same time something incredible happens somewhere in the world, you start to think, okay, you know, this is really interesting. Is the collective consciousness, does it have a force? Does it have an actual energetic force? I think one of the really interesting things about that program, though, is that they found out that even right before these events would occur, the activity would become start becoming non-random, as if on a collective level many of us knew something, you know, whether maybe we knew it subconsciously, but we knew something was going to happen.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty amazing to I haven't looked into it. Are they still doing it?
They still are, and there's another experiment that I know Lynn McTaggart, who wrote a book called The Field about the zero-point field, which is one of the most influential books that I've ever read and really helped, you know, kind of build a foundation for our concept of the grid. She has what's called the intention experiments, and so that's an ongoing thing where they'll ask people to put out a specific intention in a sort of mass way, you know, mass consciousness, and then report back, they'll report back the data. And it's really interesting. I mean, they've had some experiments where they've had people, I don't want to say pray, but just sort of think about growing a little seed in a sterile vial, you know, a vial of sterile water. Well, the seed shouldn't have grown in that, but it did because enough people were thinking. So does that mean that thought has actual, you know, form and force and power? So I know that those are going on. I know Larry said that the Global Consciousness Project is still going on, but I haven't heard very much about it in terms of, like, this big, the Malaysian airline disaster. So I don't know if, you know, maybe they lost some of their funding. I'll have to check into it and see, because I know that there are still really major things going on around the world that if they can continue to show that there's a collective uptick in that, you know, non-random data, that definitely all of our minds must be connected on some level. All of our consciousness must be connected on some level.
Yeah, I believe it is. What do you know about the collider over in what, Switzerland or France?
Oh, I love that. I want to go see that. Although my dad was a scientist, and he used to tease me by telling me stories about the things that could happen. Like, you know, he said, oh, if they create a little tiny mini black hole and it's not in a vacuum, a complete vacuum, that it could start eating away at everything around it, and it'll happen so fast that the, you know, entire planet would be destroyed. And he would tell me things like that. But I've been fascinated with that because really what they're doing there is, you know, slamming particles together, which sounds like, huh, what? But the idea is to try to find out what happened at the first moment that the universe was formed, the Big Bang, what might have happened right before, immediately after, how matter formed, how planets and galaxies and star systems formed, but also whether there are other dimensions, whether there are parallel universes. I mean, there's so many different things that they can learn just by looking at the behavior of particles. You know, the quantum world is, in my opinion, more fascinating and more paranormal than the cosmic world. So I don't understand a lot of what they're doing, but it's just amazing that they even built that thing as big as it is.
I was wondering, where did they get the money to do that?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I think it's a joint project of several different countries because, you know, it's in Switzerland, but I think Italy had some part in it. And, you know, I think it's that kind of thing where researchers from different parts of the world can go there and do their experiments. But it's just fascinating because it's like, you know, if we look at what happens at the particulate level, it may tell us how life came about. It may tell us how we came about.
Okay, so I'm going to go back to my questions now in your book. What do religion and myth say about the grid?
You hear things like the kingdom of heaven is laid out before you, but you cannot see it, yet you're immersed in it. You hear about these wonderful sort of primordial places where all life has been and all forms sprang forth. And myth, you hear about a lot of voids. I mean, a lot of times the word void will be used, from which the gods and goddesses began to arise. And then, of course, people and other and animals and other things came from. So it's almost like you have this primordial soup from which everything comes from, or you have this invisible void. And to me, to us, it really sounds like that there's a global understanding that there's a hidden order that is creating everything, and that we are just really immersed in the manifestation, the physical manifestation of what is going on in that hidden order. We get to see all the we get to see all the effects. The cause occurs somewhere else. All different religions, all different mythologies talk about creation as coming from this type of point of either singularity, God spoke the word being resonance, vibration, you know, the sound, which has creative power, created light. Here again is a very scientific creative force from which everything came forth. You hear talk about vast seas, bodies of water from which all life sprang forth and does return to when it dies. So it's just a really common motif that you hear throughout religion, throughout mythology, whenever people are talking about how everything began. And I think it's because there's a part of us that I think subconsciously knows that even though what our eyes see is very real to us, we can knock on things and everything feels physical, we can touch everything, I think most of us are very much aware that the generative creative force exists on a hidden level.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah.
Do certain environmental effects trigger access to the grid?
This is one of the really interesting things that we learn from doing a lot of work in the paranormal field. And, Larry has an organization that was doing a lot of paranormal investigations, looking for evidence of ghosts and entities and spirits. And one of the things that we began to see is that you could have a room full of people, maybe 20 people, and you can be in a location that may or may not be haunted, who knows, but if you say this is a location that is haunted, a number of those people will actually have an experience. Now, they're not making it up because sometimes they really will be able to physically report that something happened, something touched them or hit them or they saw something. And what we started to wonder is, okay, what is it about the environment working in conjunction with our own physiology, our own bodies, that may allow some people to experience other realities, others not at all? So we have to look first at the environment. You know, could the climate, could weather, could barometric pressure have anything to do with why somebody suddenly sees something that we don't normally see? The presence of water seems to be a real hot thing. You know, why are there places all over the world where there seems to be more paranormal activity than others? Is it the geomagnetic activity in that area that's a little bit different, the electromagnetic anomalies that maybe occur there that don't occur somewhere else? So we ask a lot of those questions in the grid. And then we also, though, want to know what we have to do with it, because I think we're the deciding factor in all this. So how are our own bodies interacting with our environment to allow some of us to be able to manifest or perceive a paranormal experience, which I consider to be activity on another level of the grid?
What is our role in shaping our personal and collective reality from the grid?
Again, because we have consciousness, which seems to be a creator of reality, a generator of reality, and really perception, how we perceive reality. I think our role is that we very well might be creating reality. We might be doing it as we go along, and yet at the same time, I think that we're also creating it on a collective level. So in other words, we have our personal individual realities. But we also have a collective reality that we all sort of buy into as human beings, where a chair is a chair and a plane can fly through the sky and a dog is a dog. I mean, those are collective beliefs that we accept as part of our reality. But one of the really interesting things comes from quantum physics, where the behavior of a subatomic particle can be directly influenced by the act of observation or measurement. So therefore, what that means is that an observer can change the outcome of a particle's behavior. Now, does that also happen at the grander scale? Could we, as observers and measurers of reality, be changing, be creating, be shifting things? Our focus as observers, maybe we're only seeing one reality because that's what we're focused on. Is there a way that we can shift the focus of our perception to observe into reality another part of the grid? And so those are the things that we look at in terms of our role. We think human beings are the common denominator in the perception of any reality, whether it's the one right in front of our faces or the ones that we kind of get little hints and glimpses of as we go along. We're really the common denominator.
You know, I have long been studying and looking at something that I call the crystal grid and how the planet is put together with quartz crystal. Can you give us some insight for things that maybe you've run across that support this theory?
I think that's really interesting. Gosh, I wish Larry was here to talk about that because he's from Arkansas, where they have some of the best crystal mining, and he goes all the time and just gets these gorgeous crystals. And they have, They are conductors of electricity. They do have the ability to change the electromagnetic field. Now our bodies have electromagnetic fields as well, so therefore the belief is that crystals can also change the resonance and the vibrational frequency of our bodies. I mean, our hearts and our brains give off EM fields. So there could be this grid of electric and energetic exchange that goes on between all of the crystals all over the world, and we know that they're everywhere, that is somehow changing our electromagnetic field or influencing it in such a way that it may also in turn influence our physiology. Maybe it can open the third eye. Maybe it has an influence on our consciousness, or maybe it has an influence on the dreams that we have. So it's really interesting because I think nature provides all of the answers for all of the mysteries that we're all trying to figure out. And, excuse me, it's just up to us to put all those puzzle pieces together. And so all of these things are different parts of this sort of grand blueprint of realities and really what the structure, the foundation of these realities are.
Well, it's funny you mention Arkansas because we have something called the Starseed Crystal Quest that we have twice a year. And in a couple of weeks, we'll be meeting our group there in Hot Springs.
Oh, good.
And,
well, I'm glad you didn't go this week with the tornadoes. Oh, my gosh. I'm so glad you didn't go this week. But from what I hear, they've got just the most amazing mines and just the most wonderful crystals that people find. And, I really think it does change the environment.
Yes.
But also
does.
The people that hold them, I don't know how you cannot be affected by something that sort of absorbs the environment or changes it or influences it because of its own properties. That has to affect our physiology, which is why so many people feel good around crystals or they're able to feel some type of healing or some type of outcome based on what type of crystal.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, we have a really wonderful time twice a year taking our groups there, and we have so many high strangeness things that happen.
Yeah, it's
there.
Like the
yeah, a lot of ET contact, a lot
yeah.
of high spiritual knowingness, and the people that come together, they seem to know each other, because we base it on that discovery of star markings that I do, and we do their charts. We find people that have the common denominator of star markings in their charts. That's how we actually pick the people to go on our trip.
Right, right. So everybody feels comfortable. I think sometimes that opens people up more to experiencing, you know, these other levels of reality, as if they're not stressed or afraid or sort of blocked. You know, if people are open, if they feel comfortable, if they feel trusting of who they're with, I think that that allows them the opportunity to have more experiences.
Well, I don't have a copy of your new book, so I don't know what to ask you. So why don't you just tell us a little bit about this new book that you've written?
I will. After we did the grid, we wanted to do something a little bit different. So we did. We wrote a book called Viral Mythology, How the Truth of the Ancients Was Encoded and Passed Down Through Legend, Art, and Architecture, one of the longest titles ever. But what it's about, I mean, we talk so much today about how information and stories and ideas and memes go viral because of the internet, because of texting, because of the ease by which technology has allowed me to, within a matter of seconds, talk to a total stranger on the other side of the globe. That's where we're at today. We're such a global community when it comes to taking things viral and spreading ideas in ways that we never could before. But we wondered how information spread primitive times. We wanted to know, was there any scientific or historical truth and accuracy to the art, the drawings and caves and on rocks, to glyphs, you know, in Egypt on the side of ancient edifices, the writings, stories, mythologies, religious writings, all the way up to fairy tales and folklore and legends. Is there real historical scientific truth embedded in the information that has made it to us today from ancient times? And that really sort of prompted us to write this book, to look at that. It's really fascinating because there are a lot of theories as to how information might have spread from, say, one country to another thousands of years ago, one civilization to another, without the internet, without cell phones. And one of the most popular is the ancient alien, ancient astronaut theory. And, of course, that's hugely popular now with the show on the History Channel. And the idea is that in order for us to have some of the leaps in technology and scientific knowledge and understanding that we've had in our past, and in order for ideas to have leapt from one geological region to another, did we possibly have a little bit of help from our friends from other civilizations off the planet, our friends from above? And so that's a fascinating theory. You look at some of the art and the drawings on the sides of caves and on rock edifices, and you look at some of the stories and myths, even in the Bible, about chariots in the sky and images of people that look like they have helmets and moon suits on. And there's just so much of this in our past. Where did it come from? Were they imagining the future, or were they really interacting with these beings that were helping them to advance ideas, to spread information, to spread innovation?
Well, I think that the crystal grid might have had something to do with it, because people can, say, take off their shoes, lean up against a tree for the antenna, put their feet in the ground, and just travel the crystal grid and be able to maybe, you know, be here in the United States, and somehow you can travel to Peru in your mind and with your body and the tree and the crystal grid. You see what I'm saying? It all kind of works together.
Yeah, I do. And that's another one of the theories that we looked at for how ideas and information spread in ancient times. You know, Carl Jung referred to the collective unconscious. And again, we refer to the grid. Is there, what is that part of us, whether it's the mind or consciousness, that is able to travel across worlds, across realities, across time frames, into the past, into the future? And is that where these ideas came from? The zero-point field, which is the sort of scientific version of the grid, which is sort of a repository field for all matter and form that ever existed and ever will exist. It's literally like a sea of virtual particles that pop in and out of existence. Well, this is the scientific end of it. And yet, the theoretically, there is a belief that you can time travel in the grid, the zero-point field, because, again, there's no past, present, and future. Everything is there. So if you can find the method by which you can travel, you could literally go from one time frame to another. Now, why could not our past ancestors have tapped into these fields of information, whatever you want to call them, the Akashic field, the kingdom of heaven, the book of life, the crystal grid, the zero, you know, I mean, there's so many different names for this concept of a field of information that we can tap into at any time, and we can see into the past, and we can see into the future. We can access ideas that we didn't have access to normally. So aliens may not have been needed. We could have been doing this on our own.
Oh, I think that we had a lot of ET help.
You know, it's so funny because after we looked at all the different theories, another of the theories was cultural evolution. Another one was, you know, something in our genetic history involved with this. But it's so funny because after we looked at everything, it was almost like, well, you know what? All of these seem like they could be have been all happening together just as maybe today.
Oh, I think,
excuse me. They all are happening together, you know.
You're onto something there.
Yeah.
I think it's all the above.
Yeah, I do too. And that's kind of frustrating for some people because when they read a book, they want like one solid answer. And you're saying, well, look, you know what? There's, we call it circumstantial evidence. There's circumstantial evidence for all of these theories, including, you know, many traditional archaeologists will say, look, the concept of the pyramids, we have pyramids in Egypt, we have them in Korea, we have them in Cambodia, we have them in Bolivia, and many of them are dated to have been built around the same time, and they look the same. What happened? Okay, one theory, aliens gave us the technology and they spread it to many different civilizations. They didn't just give it to one. Second theory, we thought of it all at the same time because we were all evolving at the same sort of genetic and you know, physical and consciousness rate of evolution. Another idea, somebody in Bolivia tapped into the field, somebody in Korea did, somebody in Egypt did, and they all said, aha, pyramid, or word of mouth. I mean, there really was some travel by foot, by animal, and by sea that could have spread different ideas. And we look back and think, oh, these things happened overnight, but they really didn't. They probably happened over the course of hundreds of years. But you can find evidence for all of those theories, and that's what I think is so fascinating, is that there's so many different factors at play in our past, just like there are today in our present, and I'm sure will be in our future.
I have a theory about Atlantis, and I'm picking up a lot of stories from a lot of different people at different times in my sessions. And one of the themes that seems to be rising up right now is that a lot of beings came from the Pleiades to help the scientists of Atlantis. And when they saw they couldn't help them, they got in their mini ships and they went to different places on the planet, and they set up substations, and they started building these pyramids and started knowing that Atlantis was not going to be there for long. They they went and started populating different parts of the world. That seems to be a theme that's happening right now with a lot of my clients.
Well, and if you think about what we humans would do if we're trying to, say that you're an owner of a huge corporation and you want to expand, you want to kind of spread your ideas and your brand, you might not just go to one country to tell them about this new invention that you have. You might go to 10 or 12 to drum up business, to make connections. And I think that there's been so much focus on Egypt as having been, and Samaria, as these areas of having been the receptors of extraterrestrial intelligence to help them advance. But I think it's entirely possible, as you said, that if that theory is true, and we don't know, but if it is true, why would an alien civilization just limit their spread of knowledge to one or two cultures? Why not sort of travel the planet spreading the word of what you know, trying to educate the humans? And that might be the explanation for the reason why there are pyramids that looked exactly the same in Bolivia and in Korea that were built the same, step pyramids that, have the same numbers of step levels and just the importance of that shape to begin with in so many different cultures.
And how about the Bosnia pyramids?
Exactly. We didn't even know about those till fairly recently. I'm sure there's pyramids that we still haven't found yet. But the thing is that the more that we see these common things pop up all over the world, the more it seems to lend credence to the idea that the information, the idea of building these types of edifices was given to different cultures, different civilizations around the same general time. And it was the same general information. In other words, there may be differences between cultures and civilizations. There always are. There's regional differences. But when you have every civilization on the planet building a pyramid-shaped object, whether for a tomb or, what have you, some type of holy, sacred site, it kind of makes you wonder, okay, where did that idea come from and how did it spread so quickly all across the globe and become important to all these different cultures despite their regional differences?
Yes, I agree. Well, I would like to know a little bit about, you wrote a book, I think, about fiction, about a kid's book or something about bullying. Would you tell us a little bit about that book?
Oh, yeah. Now, I have written 12 nonfiction books, and I just signed to write my 13th. But my first love had always been to write fiction, to write novels, and it was something that I sort of took a really long detour from, writing all of these nonfiction books pretty much back to back. But my son, he's now 13. When he was 10, when he was much younger, he was being bullied in elementary school, and he walked with a very severe limp. He'd had a number of surgeries from a disability, and I kind of knew that he was being bullied, but he seemed to be taking it well. He seemed to be handling it okay. The school was really good about stuff like that. Well, I come to find out that he started an organization, a spy organization, with his friends who were also being bullied. They sort of kind of came together, made their own tribe. And it grew into this unbelievably sophisticated entity where they had their own websites, they had trainings and missions, they had different ranking systems, they wore spy gear to school. The concept behind the group, which was called ECHO, E-K-H-O, Evil Kid Hunting Organization, was to spy on the bullies and to stay one step ahead of them so that the kids could avoid being in trouble, and also to kind of band together the kids that are being bullied, give them their own group that they could feel confident and strong about. So I kind of knew some stuff was going on. I'd hear my son talking with his friends about Echo, 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 and I thought, oh, how cute. They have their little club. But I had no idea until a little later how huge it had become. My son had built a huge website. It was encrypted. He was writing code. He was hiding missions so that if they were hacked, which they were hacked many times, you know, the bully kids wouldn't find out the missions. Come to find out that the bullies formed a counter-agency called DEEK, Destroy Echo Kids Everywhere. The teachers kind of knew what was going on, but, I mean, it was, you know, it was not really hurting anybody. In fact, if anything, it was helping kids not get bullied. And it just became so unbelievably sophisticated that I was, like, blown away that my son had done this. And I had talked to a TV producer a couple of years ago and just told her, I said, just listen to what my son did. And she just went nuts. She said, oh, my God. That would be a great TV series for kids. They would love it. It would inspire them. It would help them. But you really need to write it as a book series first. And I thought, oh, God, I'm just too busy. I've got these nonfiction books. And then I signed with a manager, Italia Gandolfo, in late 2012. And I told her about Echo, and she said, that's it. Write the book. I wrote it. We sold it immediately. It's now being looked at for film and TV. We have book two coming out in the spring. And it's just been a really wonderful tool to show the resourcefulness of some kids, you know, when they're being bullied and how they used technology and their love of technology, their nerdiness, their geekiness to sort of fight back and make a stand. So it's been getting so well received. We are talking to some anti-bullying groups about sharing profits with them and donating some of the royalties. So, and it's made my son feel really confident. He, unfortunately, for the last 2 years has been homebound, very, very sick, and having some upcoming surgeries and all kinds of treatments and health issues. So this has been a real bright spot in his life. And he's still best friends with the kids that made up the beginnings of Echo, which I think is really amazing.
So does he spend time on the computer still working with this concept,
Echo,
even though he's at home?
Now that he's in junior high and he hasn't been going to school, Echo kind of ended. It was really something that was through fifth grade, through elementary school. He's been on online charter school for the rest of this year. Hopefully, he will go back to his normal eighth grade. He's got big surgeries coming up this summer. But he was able to maintain the friendships. The kids that he started Echo with, they're all still this very tight group, tight unit that looks out for each other. I know that the short amount of time Max did go to junior high, he said that there were some kids that, you know, were teasing him and bullying him, but he feels a lot more confident now because of what he did in elementary school. So, I don't want to say that it's completely passed for him because he hasn't been in school, but I do think now that he has proven to himself that he and his friends can take a stand. We hear about a lot of bullying going on in the junior high schools here. What's wonderful, the area that I live in San Diego, California, they have such a zero tolerance policy, and the teachers and the staffs are awesome about shutting it down. But I think it's really cool when you can inspire kids to take action and not have that action be violent. You know, it's like, don't fight violence with violence. Don't bully the bullies. And that's what made me so proud of what he did, is he found a way to shut them down where he didn't have to stoop to their level and fight and get violent or, you know, do anything illegal or anything bad.
Well, that's amazing. I really love this story, and I really hope that we see a movie or a mini series about this. And it's so needed now because of so many things that are happening in schools, and most of the outrageous attacks, they all track it back to being bullied. I'm noticing that.
It's awful. I see so much of it. And what I think is so important, you know, not every kid is going to go start a spy agency, but the concept of banding together with, I know a lot of bullied kids feel very much alone. They feel like they're loners. And in this case, it was just wonderful how they found each other through Echo. Echo was an opportunity to bring kids together that were, you know, could have ended up being alone and having to deal with that alone and maybe really would have gotten hurt. But because they came together and formed their own tribe of kids that understood them and related to them, there's power and strength in numbers. And so I always feel so much just empathy when I hear about these loner kids that get bullied and they just, you know, they have no outlet. They don't know where to turn. And I think to myself, wow, I bet you there's 10 other kids in your school that feel that way. How do we bring these kids together to form their own tribe? But, yeah, it's just, and you kind of wonder, why are kids, I guess kids have always bullied each other. This isn't new, and maybe because we just are so exposed to the news so much more we hear about it. But you got to wonder, is that natural behavior, or are they learning it from their parents, or is it because they're being abused at home? And in Echo Book 2, we actually want to explore that a little bit. We want to just kind of look at what makes kids bullies. Are they, they're not evil. I don't think any child is born evil or, you know, bad. So what are some of the things that might have happened to these kids to make them lash out this way?
Well, I think your book, and if the movie comes out, you'll probably see more kids wanting to form their own organizations like your son has done.
Yeah, and as long as they don't take the same road that the bullies take, keep the high road. You know, I always told my son, I don't ever want to see you bullying someone because you know how it feels. You know, sometimes he has a friend or two that he'll kind of pick on a lot. And I'm like, dude, just be careful. You know, make sure that they're okay with the way that you guys treat each other, because when the bullied start becoming bullies, then you have not broken that chain. And I know that that probably happens a lot more than we think. That bullied kids, you know, end up growing up to be bullying adults, and the chain never gets broken. So it's
a lot of that. Well, Marie, I have really enjoyed you being on the show, and I'm going to pass you over now to Arielle, who has the switchboard, and there may be some people that want to call in. And,
well, thank you so much.
Yeah, and thank you so much for being on our show and bringing this wonderful information about the grid. And also about this project, this new project that you've been working on, the new book, and the bullying book, and hopefully a movie will be made.
That
feels really good to me. I feel really strong about that.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate
that. I can see that happening.
Thank you so much.
Great.
Okay, back to you, Arielle.
Okay. Well, we do have some callers with questions, and actually, let's pick up one right now. He's ready. Been waiting to talk to you. This is Ralph. Hello, Ralph. You are on the air. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Arielle. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Well, sure. You have a question for Marie?
Yeah, it's been a phenomenal show. And Marie, I really enjoyed your comments. I had a couple questions on two of your books. But first, I wanted to let you know I really send my most heartfelt sympathies for your son and what his illness is, and we really see him kind of regaining his wholeness. So I just want to send him some love.
Oh, thank you.
And I had a question about the book. This book is from the future in regards to time travel, and I hope that Arielle or Lavender don't ding me on being a conspiracy theorist. But anyway, I just want to know if you're familiar with Anthony Bushago. and
yeah,
Project
we wrote
Pegasus.
The Montauk kids we wrote a little bit about that. We did cover time travel conspiracy theories because here's my take. Where there is smoke, sometimes there's fire. So you can't – now, I'm not saying that I think that everything he says is true. I'm very much on the fence. I've heard a lot of his interviews. I've never met him in person, you know, read a lot of his articles, and I understand where he's coming from in the story that he tells – excuse me, the fact that he tells it with such great detail. I don't want to make a judgment call because I wasn't there and I don't know what happened. But, you know, my feeling is when you make claims like that, you've got to be able to prove something. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they do remain conspiracy theories. And while conspiracy theories really are, again, like smoke, which could indicate the presence of real fire, they can also just indicate the presence of smoke. So we presented the Roswell time travel connection, Bisaggio, some of the other people that said that they were as children trained to be chrononauts and time travelers and some of the time travel urban legends. And we tried to do it very objectively while also saying, you know, while there's no absolute proof of any of this,
right,
we can't say for sure this didn't happen. Maybe
yeah.
it did, or maybe it happened in a way that these people time traveled more interdimensionally rather than in a physical sense of jumping from the past, present, or future in this particular universe. Mm. You know, it's like, we don't really know. So
right.
I try to take an open mind, sort of sitting on the fence position, because something may seem really out of this world to me, no pun intended, but I don't want to feel arrogant enough to say, oh, that person's full of crap. That never happened. Because you know what? I wasn't there.
Right.
So 75% of me may be saying, I don't think I believe that. But the other 25% is saying, wouldn't it be something if they were telling the truth?
Right. Well, I guess it needs to be seen. He's supposed to be... well, on one timeline, I suppose he's supposed to end up being president, so I guess that'd be interesting.
I
want to
see proof.
Yeah, right. That would be, I guess that maybe
I'm kind of that way. I was raised by a scientist father, so I'm still kind of like, show me. I believe you, but show me proof.
The other question is about the other book, Reality. The Grid.
Uh-huh.
We talk about reality, and again, this can be construed as a little bit of a conspiracy theory, and it's about the existing technology that's being used, or proposed to be used, to remotely create like holograms in the minds of people, and not only that, create thoughts and emotions, and I was wondering if you're familiar with that, and...
let's
Project
put it this way. I will be because Larry Flaxman, my co-author, and I, we just this week signed a new book deal for a book called Mind Wars, The History of Mind Control and Electronic Surveillance. And we'll be covering a lot of that stuff. You know, is it possible to control somebody's mind from afar? Is it possible to manipulate and change people's thoughts? And so that is something I am, over the next 6 months, going to be researching heavy duty and writing about. The book won't be out till next spring, but it's so funny that you ask that because I do believe that technology exists. It's so funny if you just watch, like I belong to a lot of these sort of physics news sites or cutting-edge science, you know, cutting-edge neurology, and oh my gosh, some of the stuff that they are doing is, it sounds like science fiction. But then you think back to the science fiction of the late 1800s and you realize how much of that has come true.
Right.
And I think we have technology now that is doing stuff that many of us don't even want to know about. Do we really want to know?
The guy that, I think it's a book called Project Bluebeam, by Serge Monast, M-O-N-A-S-T, Monast,
uh-huh.
That really gets into seven different scenarios, whether you want to believe it or not, this really exists or not, but it actually falls under nonfiction, so somebody believes it. But anyway, I thought that was pretty interesting that you mentioned that you did believe that the past, present, and future are happening simultaneously.
Yeah.
And that you believe in the existence of the multiverse.
I have for a long time, and again, I have to thank having a father who was a physicist for that, because my dad, many, many years ago, he passed away a couple of years ago, but many, many years ago, my dad and I had a conversation about quantum physics, and he was telling me about how everything vibrates, nothing is real, you may be, you know, sitting in your chair and you think it's solid, but it's really not, it's vibrating particles, and there's nothing but, you know, space in between them, and I ended up writing a book called Science, P-S-I-E-N-C-E, which was about quantum physics as a possible explanation for paranormal phenomenon from that conversation. And it just absolutely blew my mind, because the more I learned about the world that happened at the quantum level, the more some of the things that happened at this grander scale that we exist on made sense to me. And, you know, we say that we can't time travel into the past, because if you ruin the past, well, then wouldn't you ruin everybody's present and future? You know, how do you get past all those paradoxes? The multiverse is the perfect way to get around that, the idea that there are other realities, other timelines. So you may ruin one,
right,
but you're not going to ruin the ones that branch off from that. And it's just amazing how some of the most mind-blowing, paranormal-sounding stuff is coming out of quantum and theoretical physics.
Right. And you had the book that you wrote on ghosts. I was kind of surprised that you had a book on ghosts and spirits and things like that, especially under your nonfiction list there. But, again, this multiverse concept and the multidimensional concept, I believe, plays right into, and I haven't read that book, but I mean, it seems to will play right into what those phenomena are about.
Well, absolutely. But, and that's why I wrote it, because I think that there, and not just with ghosts, but this I think also applies to UFOs, to cryptozoology, to entities that people see. I think that there are a number of different things possibly going on here. Sure, maybe some people are seeing the sort of energetic leftover essence of a dead person that they knew and loved. But to me, it makes more sense to describe a ghost as possibly a living entity in another reality, another dimension, another timeline, a parallel universe, that for whatever reason, we in this reality are getting momentary glimpses of. And because that happens to so many people, one of the reasons why Larry and I wrote The Grid is because we wanted to start looking at, okay, if you've got, you know, Joe who's seeing a ghost and Mary who's standing right next to him and she's not seeing anything, does that mean Joe's a liar? Well, no. Maybe because of his physiology, his brain chemicals, his blood type, whatever, and how it's interacting with the environment, it's a little bit different for him than it is for Mary. So his brain is allowing him to perceive an entity in another dimension, whereas her brain is not, because she doesn't have the same chemicals at play, or because she's not interacting with the environment in the exact same way. Those are kind of the things that we really wanted to look at. It's like,
yeah, that concept is very interesting, but when a group of people, there's a group of people down in South America who saw the vision of Mother Mary in a tree, or a burning bush or something,
right.
I can't recall what it was, but that really kind of points back to, well, still, you need to really use your discernment and kind of maybe consider that maybe there is some kind of mind control that exists, some kind of technology that exists to cause a group of people to also have these kind of visions.
Well, there is a lot of I was in MUFON, Mutual UFO Network, for a long time. Mm. I remember being so kind of freaked out by UFO reports that would come in from people, and the people would say, you know what, it wasn't like a craft that, you know, zoomed from one part of the sky to the other. They'd say, Marie, it was so weird. It was like it just appeared and then flickered out and disappeared, like I was watching a movie projector on a screen.
Mm.
And so later when I started reading about, the holographic universe theory and how things could be projected onto our reality from another dimensional reality, I started to think, wow, I'll be darned if maybe those people were actually seeing things that were being projected into our reality.
Mm.
So you're right. We could be getting projections of images, entities, thoughts. We may be bombarded with information that is coming from other sources, and we're not even aware of it. We just sort of absorb it and take it as a part of our day-to-day reality.
Yeah, so I guess it's true. We should maintain our discernment.
Yeah.
Stay
aware. Well, you know, look how distracted people are today with technology and social networking and this and that and the TV and blah, blah, blah. We're so distracted now that it's so easy for somebody to get into our minds and do whatever they want because we're just not as aware of our surroundings. We're very numb and we're very distracted.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Entertaining my questions, and very interesting. Just, I don't know where to start with your books. You have so many. I'm going to look.
Take your pick.
Look through the, yeah, I'll review them and see. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling, Ralph. Good to hear from you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. So we have another caller with a question for you, Marie.
Uh-huh.
And is it Rhea? How do you say your name?
You said it just right.
Oh, great. Well, Rhea, you are on the air with Marie, and you have a question for her.
Hi, Rhea.
Hi, Rhea. Hi. I'm sorry. I'm bad with names right now because I just finished work, and I'm just winding down, so I'm listening to you guys.
Winding down. That sounds good.
Yeah, so I was hearing what was going on with their son. You know, my heart goes out to all of them, even the bullies. I just wanted to know, has it actually stopped? Because to me it seems like what they had done with the spy network on opposite sides, it seems like it's more of a redirection than actually stopping it.
Deke didn't last for long, luckily. When my son and his friends graduated fifth grade, one of the things that they had done is in fifth grade, they mentored kindergarten and first graders, and some of them would come with stories of being teased, and they were able to teach them to stand up for themselves. I'm sure the bullying is still going on now that my son is in junior high school, but our hope is that maybe they left behind enough kids that, you know, were ECHO members or really just learned how to band together and kind of stand up for themselves. Now, junior high school is a lot rougher. He's been out most of the last couple of years with his disability and with a chronic stomach condition. And so, in a way, I don't know if that's good or bad because he hasn't been there to have to deal with junior high-level bullying. But at the same time, you know, he just physically couldn't. So the goal now is to just keep his confidence going. And he sees a therapist, and he has people to talk to help him so that when he's ready to go back into eighth grade or if he goes into high school and does eighth grade at home, I want him ready to face the world. You know, I want him to remember the things that he achieved. He's still achieving things with technology that are blowing my mind. I mean, this is a child who probably, if he wanted to, could hack into, you know, any organization he wants. I mean, he writes code. He creates websites. He designs video games. He mods other people's video games. So I'm pushing him to... express that part of himself because that's where his strength is.
Mm-hmm.
And so if he does go back into school, you know, he's got that confidence. He's got that strength. He knows there are things that I can do that maybe other kids can't. So that if people do tease him, and hopefully by the time he's in high school, he won't have the physical stuff. It won't be so prominent. He's having two knee surgeries and hamstring surgeries.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't know what the future holds, but I think Echo really strengthened him. It empowered him. It makes him proud. If you talk to him about it, he'll get kind of embarrassed, but at the same time, he'll just start gushing about different stories of, you know, what they did and the kids that they helped. And
mm-hmm.
our goal with Echo, because it is supposed to be an ongoing book series, is that eventually we want to have a website devoted to Echo where kids can participate and sort of form their own missions, and they can talk to my son and his friends and, you know, tell their stories. That's all part of what we're hoping to do. The book just came out in February, so we're hoping that it kind of grows in. We're working with some groups, Rockers Against Bullying, Kids and Teens Against Bullying, which is an organization that Ellen DeGeneres is involved with and loves. So we want to kind of take it to the next level so that he can still continue to feel like he can help kids, even if he himself is not physically at school.
I see.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just that bullying is just really like a socialized phenomenon. It's like, well, you know, over time, you know, they learn to deal with it. But you were mentioning the stomach issues, because when you're being on alert for a bully, that creates a lot of anxiety and tension.
Oh, absolutely.
And the body's going to resonate immediately.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, I don't think people realize how bullying hurts kids, not just mentally, but it causes physical illnesses and chronic illnesses and anxiety and depression. My son was lucky. I mean, I hear, and you know, going into high school, I'm going to be very nervous, but I'm also very, very involved. So I keep a real close eye on what goes on. But you hear about kids committing suicide, and I just, oh, my heart just breaks for them because I feel like, oh, if only they could have found a few more kids that at that school that felt the same way. They could have felt a little bit more strength in numbers. And how can we help kids find each other? You know, I was bullied. One of the things with Echo is that it's dedicated to a woman who literally saved my butt when I was in grade school in New York. I was being bullied, as was my sister, by a girl who was very violent and who threatened to cut us with knives. And just out of the blue, this woman, you know, child, this girl named Maria Figueroa came along, and she was a big girl. She was tough. I was afraid of her until I realized that she was there to help us. And she literally laid down the law with this girl and her friends and said, if you ever, ever touch Marie or Angela, you're going to have me to face. And she protected us. And to this, I found her on Facebook a couple of years ago. We reconnected. So when Max and I wrote Echo, we made sure to give it a special dedication to her.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I, you know, so many of us have been bullied and teased for something or other. And I just wish there was a way that we could get to kids early to teach them about accepting differences. I don't know if it's just a part of life that kids have to go through where they don't understand differences and they want to attack each other for it. I don't know.
I don't think it's normal. I don't think it's normal. It's socialized. It just the way you're saying it, people think, oh, it's normal, it's just a phase, they'll get over it. But, you know, when a kid is not at peace, it does a whole lot to them, even spiritually.
Right. So, but you have to wonder why the bullying kids are like that. Is it because of the way that they were raised? Or is it genetic? You know, those are the things that I wish I knew more about, and I'd like to, because I feel an empathy for bullies because I feel like they couldn't have just been born that way?
I doubt it. It's the way they've been raised. It's the way they've been socialized. And it's the way they've been treated at home and what they've been taught.
Sort of a combination of all those factors.
It's a combination of all of those factors. When you keep telling your kids, well, look at this person, or anything else that, oh, we don't like this is different, or that is different. When you keep making distinctions of differences that are not fair, they're going to internalize that because we're supposed to be all connected, and then people teaching your kids complete
we're
opposite.
We're all humans.
I know we're all human. It's just that if we just stop hurting each other, we'll be further along than we are now. And the parents will pay attention to what their biases are, making discussions in front of their kids. Their kids are going to internalize that.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. And I think a lot of kids grow up to be bullying adults. A lot of them don't learn. They don't change their ways. Some do, but I think a lot don't.
Anytime when there's some type of differences,
it could be wearing glasses, it could be wearing braces, it could be your height. You're absolutely right. Any kind of difference.
Or even gender. Even adults do it, on the job. It's like, oh, this person don't look like they're together.
You think we would learn better when we grow up, but no.
Because people are so negatively taught, people accept it as gospel, and that's the problem. Yeah. People are so stuck. Because everything affects even the spiritual system of our bodies. When we start to think that we're less than or we're more than somebody else,
unworthy.
It's not stop.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think worth is something that you got to instill in children, because if kids feel worthy, then they will respect themselves enough to say, hell no, you're not going to treat me that way.
And so, even adults.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of adults.
Find that low self-worth and they, I feel more worthy if I'm in this position or that position, or I feel like I'm better for whatever reason that's really not in reality and not in, collective.
Or thinking that you're worthier because you have a better job than someone, or more money, or you have more cars or a bigger house, whereas really those things can be taken away at any time, and that worth has to come from just our inherent value as human beings, and that we're all internally worthy.
We are all a spark of the Creator, and that's the only commonality that we have. Everything else that we do are just roles that we play in the day-to-day.
Right.
If people would get the understanding of that, whether they go to their spiritual group, their social group, people got to remember that we are all part of God. We are of the spark of God.
I like that. Sparks. Yeah, we're all the little sparks, and I like that idea. I agree.
I just wanted to just say that and
I appreciate it.
It's just time for us to just move forward and, learn to love ourselves and heal our own pain and, just get together. Get it together.
Well, you know what they say, you get your own house in order first, and then that adds to the good, positive energy. And it also inspires other people to get their houses in order, too.
Exactly.
So, yeah, it really does begin with us.
It does. Always begins with us as individuals. And I've been there and done that, got the keychain. And I've come a long way, and I'm the type of person when people see me, this is Rhea. She's really nice people. Just don't tick her off, because she will let you know what's going on.
Good. Straightforward, direct, truthful.
Yeah, well, that sounds like a good balance of masculine and feminine energy for me.
Yes.
Where you can stand up for yourself, but you still have the compassion and the understanding that we are one. So well done, Rhea, and we appreciate you calling in.
Thank you, Rhea.
Thanks.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And, I think that's really what the grand total of everything is, the need for the return of that feminine, which, it's, you don't have to be it's not about male and female. It is about that compassion and the feelings
right.
of. So,
and
well, I can't believe it. I mean, the time is
so
really here, hasn't it?
Yeah.
I have so enjoyed what you have to say, and my gosh, I mean, the body of work that you have created and offered on all so many subjects, I'm very grateful that you're on the planet with us.
Oh, thank you.
You know, you're so
I'm
welcome.
Curious. I'm just curious. I grew up curious, and I still am, and I think it's just that desire to always kind of peek behind the curtain and then share what I found out there.
Right. Well, you know, it's empowering for everyone when you do that, and
well,
we're so glad, and I'll be looking for that movie or mini series.
Oh, I hope so. I think my son gets the biggest kick out of that.
Yeah. You know, and I have to wonder if the norm in our culture now with two working parents has a consequence when the children at home are not with their mother. And
I'm a single mom, so I think for me it you know, might have been the exact opposite of my son not being exposed to sort of the male energy and having to find, because, you know, I tried to empower him as much as I could. I'm a tough chick. I'm a New York Italian. But I think, you know, kids are really influenced by the same-sex parent. And so because it was just Max and I for so long, I'm just really glad that he found a resourceful, nonviolent way to deal with it rather than, you know, kind of taking it all so inward and then expressing it in a real angry, violent way. So, but I know a lot of kids do, and it's just, you know, a matter of the different influences that they're exposed to and which ones win over, and, you know, hopefully as time goes on and bullying, it's just become such a huge epidemic that we really start to put our foot down and just change things. It has to start, yeah, with each individual family unit.
Yes, it does. And I commend you. I mean, Max sounds like the most amazing child, even with the challenges that he's had, that he still dealt with a difficult situation in a constructive way that empowers others.
I was surprised because he's a boy, and, you know, sometimes they can... I don't want to generalize there, but sometimes at that age, boys are more likely to lash out than to try to find resourceful ways. But I think it was really his love and obsession with technology that he, you know, he'd been obsessed with it since he was like 3 years old, that, you know, we used to kind of go, should we not let him be exposed to all this computer stuff? Well, you know what? It turned out to be his thing. And I don't know. He may end up becoming a veterinarian for all I know. But he found a way to just take what he knew and work with that. And I think all kids can do that. You know, take your gifts, take your talents, and work with those to help you deal with some of the darker sides of life.
And fortunately, he'd had access, and he had the, you know, the computer right there.
Right,
and
exactly.
He put it to good use. He put it to good use. Just such an inspiring story. And we'll be looking for Echo 2. Let us know when that. You said it's next spring that's coming out.
I believe February of 2015. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that'll be great. Well, Marie, I just want to thank you so much for spending this time with us. And Lavendar, do you have anything to add before we wrap up?
Oh, I'm just really enthralled with seeing this movie come out. I'm just really wanting to push that as much as possible. And Marie, if there's anything that we can do at Starseed Radio Academy to help you do that, any contacts or anybody you need to know about in Hollywood, please let us know.
I will. That's a wonderful offer. Thank you so much, and we'll keep you posted.
Please do. Thank you.
Absolutely. Great. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Marie D. Jones, and that's the website, M-A-R-I-E, D like David, Jones, J-O-N-E-S.com. So check it out. There's an awful lot of great material on there. So, Marie, thank you so much for being with us. Have a great week. And thank you all for listening. We will be back next week, and have a wonderful, wonderful week, everyone. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Starseed Radio Academy. Visit our website at www.starseedhotline.com.